Reading today is taken from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 2, starting to read the first verse. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. And then they offered their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
The Feast of the Epiphany, 12th night. The last of the 12 days of Christmas. If you had a particularly generous bow or true love, they would today have given you the last of 364 gifts, including 12 pipers piping, 11 drummers drumming, 10 lords a-leaping, 9 ladies dancing, 8 maids a-milking, 7 swans a-swimming, 6 geese a-laying, 5 gold rings, 4 calling birds, 3 French hens, 2 turtle doves, and a partridge in a pear tree. And if anyone tries to tell you that it's some sort of secret hidden code for the Christian faith in the days when we weren't allowed to sing Christmas carols, I'm afraid that's a load of bunkum. It's one of the wonderful little things you can find on the internet these days that everybody quotes, but actually isn't true. In fact, there's an awful lot about Epiphany that we're told that we don't really know if you only use the Bible as your source of reference. In fact, apart from the wise men, most of the birth narrative in Matthew's gospel is quietly forgotten about in churches over Christmas, because Matthew's account is rather darker than Luke's. In Luke's account, we have them being given a room. Maybe it's a guest room, maybe it's a stable. Who knows? It wasn't where they were meant to be, put it that way. It wasn't the best of rooms to have a baby in. We get the angels visiting the shepherds, peace on earth, goodwill to all men. The shepherds rush to Bethlehem, they find the baby, they leave a little lamb. No, that's not in Luke's gospel either. They leave a little lamb, they go running back to the fields, they tell everybody what they've seen. It's a great story. We just sort of shoehorn the wise men into the nativity because we all know that there are meant to be wise men in there. But just think about Matthew's account again. He talks about how Joseph decides to do the honorable thing and take Mary as his wife. But then it skips straight to Bethlehem. There's no story of no room at the inn for Matthew. That's not what's important when Matthew's telling this tale. It's not that it didn't happen. It's just Matthew has other things he wants to tell. He wants to tell the story of these three strange foreign gentlemen carrying a large amount of cash and some suspicious substances, as Micah's gang called it last year when we did our Coppers Christmas. Three astrologers, people who look at the stars. Now, there are probably more books that are written about what the Star of Bethlehem might have been than could fit comfortably on one of our tables without breaking it. It's a source of great wonder. Was it a comet? So I can't remember which particular old master painted the Nativity of Christ with a comet flying behind, and that was the Star of Bethlehem. Was it some supernatural light? Was it a supernova? There was a supernova star going exploding. It can be really, really bright. Some supernovas through history have even been visible during the daytime. Was that what the Star of Bethlehem was? There was a supernova 7 BC that the Chinese record that was visible during the daytime. Was that the Star of Bethlehem? Or maybe it was the fact that every 882 years, Jupiter and Saturn come together in the night sky. And if you're a bit short-sighted, they appear to become one bright star. They get really, really, really close. It's a line of sight thing, because Jupiter's here and Saturn's here, and they sort of line up in some sort of cosmic dance. Jupiter was associated with kings. Saturn was associated with the Babylonian deity that looked after Israel. So Jupiter and Saturn coming together is a king in Israel. Was that what they saw? We don't know. But whatever they saw, they decided it was worth following. Whatever they heard in their dreams, they decided this sign was worth investigating. Whatever they thought about what they were going to find, before they left, they chose three things to bring. Gold. I'm reliably informed that in the whole world today, above ground, including those of us that have wedding rings made out of it, there is about enough gold to comfortably fill one Olympic-sized swimming pool. That's all the gold that exists in the world today, above ground, unmined. Slightly more, I think it's about a foot above the surface of an Olympic-sized swimming pool. That's all the gold there is. All the gold that's in your computers helping them to work, all the gold that's on those wonderful audio cables that apparently make everything sound better, the gold that's in your earrings, the gold that's on your ring fingers, one Olympic-sized swimming pool. And there looks far more gold in there than there should be, because it's actually gold foil. And if you shake it up, the oil holds it in suspension. That's real gold in there, courtesy of the National Geographic. Gold was a gift of immense value. Gold was a royal gift. You would bring gold as someone of royal stature to give to someone of royal stature. People that weren't of that high office, that high societal position, wouldn't have gold. Ordinary people wouldn't have gold. Joseph and Mary probably found it quite difficult to turn that gold into cash. What are you doing with gold? There's all sorts of debates about how many of people turned up, and we don't know. But there are lots of traditions in the church over the years, dating back to sort of a couple of hundred years after the birth of Jesus. Some countries have a tradition that there were 12 kings or wise men who came to visit Jesus. We tend to have a tradition that there are three, because there are three gifts. We give them names. Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar are the three names in the Western tradition. But there are lots of countries in the world where there are dozens of wise men, oodles of wise men. I don't know what the collective noun for a collection of wise men is. It certainly isn't a politician. Bringing gold. And before they left, they decided to bring frankincense. Now, I don't know if you've ever actually come across what frankincense is. I bought some to put into my little jar there. Just put that there. I'm just going to grab a piece of frankincense for you to pass around. It's a resin from a tree. You want to have a sniff? Because actually, frankincense resin doesn't smell of very much. You can just catch a faint whiff of the frankincense. There you go. I'll pass that one around that way. Very, very faint. As someone said, it smells like St. Leonard's in Scoresby, because the Anglo Catholic churches use incense all the time. They use frankincense. It's quite a delicate flavor, it's quite a sweet smell. But what's frankincense about? Frankincense, the smoke that incense creates, was used in the temple as an image of God's presence. If you remember right back in the days of Moses, when God appeared before Moses and before the Israelites, he was a pillar of fire by day and a pillar of cloud at night. When the new temple was consecrated, the glory of the Lord filled the temple like a smoke. And the incense smoke is an image of God's presence. Incense is a gift that you offer to God. The incense was offered on the altar in the temple to God. You don't give incense sticks to your friends to make the houses smell nice. This is fabulously expensive stuff in the ancient world. $6.99 for a bag on eBay. Amazing how things change. 99p for a bottle of gold from National Geographic doing their Rocks of the Universe series, which I spotted, which is where I got these lovely little bottles from. But in the ancient world, this was fabulously expensive stuff and would be offered to God. Not to a baby. So before they even set out, they decided that the gifts that were appropriate for this baby was a kingly gift and a gift you would only give to God. And before they set out, they get a third gift. Oil of myrrh. It's a very, very thick, pungent oil. If you haven't had a chance to have a smell of it, please do at the end of the service. I'll make sure the aromatizer's working then. Or you can just sniff. There's a little bottle just behind the candles there. Take the top off and sniff the oil. Don't get it on your fingers. You'll be smelling it all day. It's a very, very odd smell. I sort of like it, but I'm not sure. It lingers. And it was the oil that was used to prepare the dead for burial. And they decided to give that to a baby as well. Now that's a weird gift to give. It's the equivalent of turning up to the maternity unit with a new coffin. Seriously. That's a really weird thing to give to a baby. No wonder it says Mary pondered all these things in her heart. She had a lot to ponder. So before they set off, they decide to bring these gifts. And they travel. They follow this sign in the sky. And what do? Where would a baby king be born? In a palace. So they go to the palace. And they meet Herod. Herod is described by all of the other sources from history as brutal and paranoid. He's terrified that his children are going to usurp him. He's terrified of the Romans who put him into power. His family isn't really Jewish-ish. He's not very popular. They go to Herod and say, "Where's the new king been born?" What would that do to someone who is paranoid? And then Matthew's gospel takes a very dark turn. The wise men are sent to Bethlehem. Herod meets with them secretly. "Let me know when you find the child so I might go and worship him too." And they go and they worship this new child. And then they too have a dream. And they're warned not to go back via Herod and tell him. They too seemingly get a clearer picture of who God is. Having seen the child, somehow they can hear God more clearly. And they go. And they go home by a different way. And the angel warns Joseph and says, "Run away." And we know what happens next. Herod kills every child under the age of two, every male child under the age of two in the vicinity. Now, Bethlehem would have been a small village, much, much, much smaller, probably smaller even than Highfields. So we're not talking hundreds, but we are talking the sort of devastation that you can imagine if that were to happen today. Herod is willing to do anything to stop this child becoming king. So we relegate the kings to a couple of Sundays after Christmas. We don't want the manger to be a messy place, thank you very much. We want it to look nice for the kiddies. But this is no nice start to the story. Jesus was born into a world where politics was cruel, self-seeking, power-hungry, where the poor were oppressed beyond belief, where the rich got to do just whatever they wanted. We could do with him today, couldn't we? So what do these gifts challenge us to do in 2019? Right back at the start of the Bible, Adam and Eve have two sons, Cain and Abel. And they both bring gifts to God. God accepts one of those gifts and rejects the other one. Cain brings some of his crops. Abel brings the first fruit, the very best of what he has to offer. And for me this year, and you might have read it already in the newsletter, for me this year, the challenge to us as a church family is, what is God getting from us? What do we give to God in our time and in our talents, the things that we're good at, and in our wallets? Is your wallet a disciple? Is your purse a disciple? Is your watch and your diary a disciple? What do we give to God? Do we give God, do we give Jesus this year a kingly gift, the very best that we have to offer? Or do we give him whatever we might be able to find in our pocket that's been left behind from the shopping yesterday? What do we give to God this year? And don't let's start thinking that this is about the amount that we give. Said this before, generosity isn't measured by how much you give. Generosity is measured by how much you have left when you've given. Someone who earns £1,000 and gives half of that away has £500. Someone who earns £1 million and gives half of that away still has £500,000. Who was more generous? This isn't about the amount we give. It's about how we give. It's about what that giving means in here. Are we giving God our very best, or are we giving him, you know, a tip? Are we giving God the best of our hours and our days, or are we giving him what's left behind when we've done what we want? Are we giving God the very best of the talents we have, or do we keep those to ourselves? For me, and I think for us in 2019, the challenge of the gift of gold is, what are we giving to God? The next gift is about giving as well, but it's a different sort of giving. It's about what we do when we worship. Many years ago, I heard a definition of worship that I love. It's a bit complicated, but I really like it. Worship, it says, is things being what they were created to be. Worship is things being what they were created to be. So someone who was born with an amazing gift of music, who offers that back to God to bring joy into the world, to lead worship, to sing in concerts, is worshiping. Someone whose gift is in technology worships when they do that. Someone's gift is service, and someone's gift is cleaning. I don't understand people who love cleaning, but they exist. I know them. Some of you are like that. That's a gift. And when you offer that back to God, when you offer that for the blessing of others, that's worship. Worship isn't just about sitting here on a Sunday morning singing the same songs again and again and again. It's about offering all that we are and all that we have back to God and being the best. And I will try to be, one of the songs we sing, the best that I can be. That's our act of worship. If your gift is administration, administer. If your gift is cooking, cook. If your gift is praying, pray. If your gift is caring, care. If your gift is singing, sing. If your gift is working in a shop, do that for Jesus. Let's offer all that we are and all that we have in worship this year. And then others will say, you do that in such an amazing way. I know I've said this before here, so I'll tell the tale quickly for those that haven't heard it. For 8 years, I worked in a small engineering firm in Newbury. And I felt at times I was a really, really rubbish witness for Jesus. I didn't always behave the way I ought to have behaved. I wasn't always a shiny, happy example of the Jesus fan club. As you know, that particular flaw has carried on in my character. A couple of years after I left, I'd been at theological college, I'd just been ordained as a deacon, we were living in Brinsworth. I got a phone call out of the blue. Hello? Hello, this is Nigel from SIL. Right, okay, this was someone that had left about a year before the company went bust. Nigel was 3 or 4 years older than I was, and he never missed an opportunity to put me down. Ever. If there was an opportunity to make fun of something that I'd said, he would take it. If there was an opportunity to diminish my contribution to a meeting, he would do it. We didn't get on. This guy's on the phone. He said, well, I found your name online on the Diocese of Sheffield website saying that you'd been ordained. Congratulations. I'm like, gee, thanks. What's coming next? He said, I'm actually ringing up to say sorry. What? He said, I'm ringing up to say sorry for the hard time I gave you when you worked at SIL. Go on. He said, I became a Christian when I was 13. I gave my life to Jesus when I was 13. But by the time I was working at SIL, I'd slidden so far away from Jesus in my faith. I didn't want anything to do with God. And you were like a toothache. You were clearly someone that was trying to live your life the way that God wanted you to do it. And you were such a witness for Jesus that every time I saw you, I hated you. Because you made me feel so guilty. So I'm really sorry that I gave you such a hard time. Because last year, I came back to Jesus. And I'm now worshiping in a church in the Netherlands. And God told me I had to ring you up and say, I'm sorry. I thought I'd been a rubbish witness for Jesus. In fact, I know I was a rubbish witness for Jesus. But God, in his infinite mercy, was able to take what I offered and challenge this young man. I haven't spoken to Nigel for years and years and years. I hope and pray that he's still going on with Jesus and doing great things. Let's offer our whole lives to worship him. And then the last gift, myrrh. The wicked fairy at the manger. There is so much sorrow and sadness in our world at present. You barely even have to walk out of your door to see it. It's in these villages. It's getting worse. First few years I was here, we saw things improving in these villages. The last 8 years, things have just been going downhill. People need hope. And you are God's plan for that. All of you, you're part of God's plan for that. The local church, Bill Hybels once said, is the hope of the world. Jesus came to deal with sorrow and sadness. Jesus came to bring healing. By his wounds, Isaiah says, we are healed. Myrrh was used as a burial oil. It was also used medicinally. It was used to bring healing. So the challenge for us in this 2019 is to take the oil of myrrh with us. To remind ourselves that Jesus died to save this world. To take the suffering of Jesus out into the world and show people that there is hope. That God can transform even the most dreadful of situations and bring hope and healing. These last 12 months, I've heard so many stories of sorrow and anguish and despair. But I've also heard stories of hope. So let's go into a world that needs myrrh, that needs us to sit and weep, that needs us to feel the pain of the world and bring that to God as well so that he can bring his healing. So you're going to see a lot of the gifts through the course of this year. I'm going to try and leave them at the bottom of the newsletter as often as there's space. Gold, what do we give to God? Are we going to give our very best to him in 2019 as a congregation, as a church family, as individuals, in our own lives and in our families? Frankincense, are we going to offer our lives as an act of worship? Are we going to commit ourselves to being in God's presence, to let him lead us and guide us? And are we going to take the sorrow of the world and offer that to Jesus and offer ourselves to Jesus as a means of that being healed? That, I think, is our challenge as a church family for this 2019, to carry the gifts that the kings brought into this year. And will it all be lovely and sweet? Away in a manger. No. No, it won't. There'll be horrors. There'll be pain. Because sadly, that's the way this old and broken world is working at present and has worked for 2,000 years and more. But the message of Christmas remains. God with us. We don't do this alone. We do it with him. We do it for him. Let's pray. Jesus, we offer you our very best today. We offer you the best of all that we are and all that we have. We offer you our worship, our lives sacrificed to you, living sacrifices. And we offer you the sorrow of our world and ask that you would help us to be part of your plan to transform it, to bring light into darkness, gladness instead of mourning, garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. May we take the wise men's gifts into this new year and so bring glory to you and see your kingdom come and your will done more fully in these villages. We ask this in Jesus' sake. Amen. So we're going to sing again. This hymn is, it feels to me often like a prayer. It's one of the gentlest of our Christmas carols. Angels and archangels may have gathered there. Cherubim and seraphim thronged the air. But his mother only in her maiden bliss worships the beloved with a kiss. What can I give him, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what I can, I give him. Give my heart. If you want to stay seated as we sing this, please do. If you want to stand as we sing this, please do. If you want to kneel as we sing this and you're able to, please do. If you can't kneel because your knees don't do that anymore, don't worry about that. I know many people whose knees do that and who do kneel but don't kneel in their hearts. What matters is whether you kneel before God in here, not whether you can do it with slightly arthritic joints. But if you're able to and you want to kneel, please do that. But let's offer ourselves to God as we sing in the bleak midwinter.